Our reading this evening, afternoon, comes from the Song of Solomon, chapter 8. Song of Solomon, chapter 8. And I'll be reading verse 5 through the end of the chapter. Who is this, coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Beneath the apple tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor and gave you birth. Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will barricade her with planks of cedar. I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. And I became in his eyes as one who finds peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He entrusted the vineyard to caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. My very own vineyard is at my disposal. 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon, and 200 are for those who take care of its fruit. O you who sit in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. Hurry, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices.
Are you impressed with the beauty of that song? Would y'all be okay asking questions and answering questions again in kind of a format like that? Is that okay? Can we conduct this as a class? Yes, sir, I would. That's fine. Thank you. Who is speaking in that text we just read? Mostly. It's the woman. It's the voice and the heart of the woman. The interesting thing about the Song of Solomon is that it is from the woman's point of view. That doesn't mean it's just for women. I suspect it's perhaps more significantly for men because it is the voice of a woman, which we need to see and hear and understand. Now, we hear the groom. But if you look closely at the book, all the scenery, all the setting, the voices, the thoughts are in her heart or from her point of view. The great wedding scene that we'll find in chapter 3 and 4 is not a scene of the bride when the organ music starts and everyone rises in the big white flowing dress. No, it's of a king in his military, entourage, coming up from the desert in royal garb, in manly kind of soldiers and armor, It's her view of her husband as a protector. And you can see it here. You can see a sense of peace. And I'm going to try to convince you that the Song of Solomon does tell a story, that there's a narrative, a time sequence, and an evolution of a relationship. But I want you to know that from the very beginning that it is really basically from the woman's point of view. Think about Proverbs. We looked at that the other night. To whom was Proverbs written? To a boy or a girl? Just on the surface.
The son.
Listen, my son. We saw those Proverbs. I don't mean to say that it's not useful for everyone, but it is a father's wisdom imparted to a son. That's at least, especially in the first few chapters, that's really the story. And even chapter 31, y'all know what's in Proverbs 31? The worthy woman? That's what women always study in the women's class, the worthy woman. Because what it says is, a worthy woman, who can be? Is that what it says? No, it's a worthy woman who can find. It's advice to a man for what to be looking for in his wife. But somehow the women study, the men don't. I don't get that. And it could be that really this Song of Solomon, though I believe written by Solomon, probably early in his life, maybe as a result of his early monogamous type love, which he later forgot in the latter part of his life, was the praise of the beauty of the romantic love between a man and a woman. Now, I know there are other interpretations, other ways people approach that. But I think that's the view. But it's interesting to me that the song is pretty much written as a narrative from the woman's point of view. You'll see that as we go through. That doesn't mean you don't hear Solomon's voice. But when you have the troubled dreams at night, guess whose dreams they are, right? And guess who has this longing in the early part of the book that's fulfilled in the latter part of the book with regard to his love expressed to her or her sense of security and peace. Did you hear that in that reading you just did? That is satisfied by the relationship. You hear that from the woman's point. And I think it's a nice balance, if you will, between Proverbs with a lot of its kind of, you know, kind of pragmatic truth, and here's the way to live, and here's what will happen if you don't. But here's this picture of a romantic relationship between man and a woman, mostly from the woman's point of view, expressing her needs, but also the groom expressing what he thinks about the relationship. All right, so I'm going to kind of give you an overview. We got these papers to pass out. Everybody's got one? Is there an extra one for me? Okay, I don't know if I have the latest version of that. Thank you. All right. I think I don't have time to cover the whole book. Though you're probably learned losing faith that I'll stop on time. But anyway, what I want to do is put a kind of a framework in place that you can begin to read the song and just study it. And there's just layers and layers of beauty and depth in the verses of the song. But I want to put a framework in place that would be maybe a tool for you to use going forward in your study of the book. I hear from several people, I heard a couple, that you maybe may study it soon as a congregation. Is that, I think it's in the works, maybe. It's like picturing the men saying, yeah, next year we'll get to it or something. But yeah, okay.
I believe it's the month of May.
Oh, okay. It is next year after all. Okay. But okay, no, that's good. And it could be studied and should be studied. I think in some ways it probably is a study that couples benefit from more about, or single people who are getting close to making some type of commitment. So look at the worksheet. And this is just some factual information we'll go through, maybe talk about to some extent, and then I will show you some structures that will help you understand the book. But I would love to read some of it with you, just to give you a sense of the layers of beauty and depth and meaning and wordplay. And believe it or not, linkage to other parts of the Bible. All right, so that's what I wanted to do. Goal number one, kind of an expository understanding. And then another goal I can't measure is maybe I'll get enough information in to improve some of the romantic relationships between some of you who are supposed to have romantic relationships that can be improved. So that's our goal. The place of the song in the wisdom writings. I've already mentioned that it is kind of a girl's eye view. Maybe it's a compliment to the Proverbs. The name of the song, and I think I have I'm sure everyone can read this Hebrew up here. You can see that. But if you look at the blue letters, you see that there's the same ones. You see? By the way, you know how you read Hebrew. It's right to left. So start on the right. And this is the word shir, ha shiri, which is a plural of song. Shir is a song, means a song. So this is song of songs. Does anybody know in the Hebrew when you say holy of holies, or you have the same word but you have a single, you know, when you put two words together they're the same word, what does that mean? What does holy of holies mean? The most holy. It's kind of a superlative. That's what that means. So in the Hebrew, shir hasharim means song of songs, or the songiest of songs is another way to think of it. Meaning it's kind of like the top of the line as far as songs go. It's a superlative statement about this poem. That interesting. To me, it is. And so, given that Solomon collected sayings and poems and wrote some, I think that's kind of quite a recommendation for the song itself. These themes of romance and the power of romantic love, we talked about in our earlier session, which is an emotion, which is appropriate in some settings and inappropriate in others. It arises sometimes unbidden. It sometimes goes away when we wish it wouldn't, right? But it can be trained and developed. That was our message in the last thing. But it's about that very emotion. It's about the development of it. It's about the nurturing of it, the protection of it in pre-marriage and a marriage setting. Okay, so I'm down to the authorship. I'm sorry, you know, it seems kind of weird that Solomon wrote it, and yet all the most we know about Solomon is he just messed up with too many wives who were just drawing him away from the Lord later in his life. I don't think that rules him out as the author, but you just have to read the song, and it says, "Songiest of songs is Solomon's." I mean, it's kind of that's kind of what it says, and you'll see a reference to the king in there, and it seems to make sense. Now, some have tried to sidestep to say, well, he collected it, or he got it, he adopted it. I don't really care about it. Now, I think it's inspired literature put in the Bible with purpose, and I attach it to Solomon, and I attach it to his wisdom that he asked for from God when he first became king. And I can place it in that setting, and I have no trouble adapting and adopting, really, the meaning that's found there. If that's true, we'll put it in the 10th century B.C., and, you know, that was a kind of a time, a height of Hebrew poetry. So the Psalms of David, right, and the Proverbs of Solomon, that fits. And the style is very compatible with that. So that's not an issue at all. It makes sense. There's a couple other technical references to Jerusalem, which puts it after David, right, or at least after that time in David's life when he took Jerusalem. And Tirzah is a city which kind of was in both, I think it was on the border or something, but it was before the divided kingdom, it would have been a prominent and beautiful city. And there's a reference to Tirzah in the book as a compliment, by the way. And so it seems like that would place it kind of before the divided kingdom. Well, that narrows it down quite a bit, right? Jerusalem, Tirzah, put them together, and you got David or Solomon's time frame. So that fits as well. It's been difficult to interpret all through the centuries. But I don't think it's because it's really difficult to interpret. And I'll show you that it isn't. It's pretty easy to see what's going on. Now, the subtleties of exactly who's speaking and which verse, there's some questions. But it makes sense what it says. Why is it so difficult to interpret? Anybody have any theories about that? Why have there been different interpretations? Two character, three character, allegory? Nathan is smirking, so he, I think he must know that answer.
Clearly, the Bible wouldn't have had a book just fully dedicated.
I know. It's just a topic you didn't expect to be in there. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, people falling in love. For guys, all that yucky stuff about, you know, being in love and all that. What's that doing in there? And so different attempts to try to explain it or maybe reinterpret it in a different way. And by the way, it's not vulgar in any way. It's beautiful. But it makes a reference to there's some things that are pretty, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Steamy? Explicit, but not really, because it's kind of metaphor, it's poetry, right? It's like a stag on the mountains, okay, but you kind of have to know what that's referring to. But when you do know what it's referring to, you know, it's a little bit off.
It's just private.
It's a very personal thing. It has some, I didn't say biology. You know, so that's been a little bit troubling, especially in an age and ages in which maybe you don't, maybe men are this way, don't like to acknowledge that there's a softer side of humans. That, and it is something that God created and approved of, and he placed in this world as a blessing to us. And it's there to be enjoyed. We talk about this so over and over, right? God made us all, every bit of us, the way we are. That doesn't mean that following our natural desires is always not sinful or is not. But enjoying it the way God intended, that's right. That is correct. And I think that's what the book is a picture of. I'll just make this point. All of the Jewish interpreters, they tended to, their way of escaping the kind of the literal, you know, mushy interpretation of it was to make an allegory of the nation of Israel and Jehovah. And are there places in the Old Testament where Jehovah is presented as a husband to a wife and the wife's unfaithful? We talked about one of those earlier. Ezekiel 16, if I have time, we may just take a peek at that. But I'll just tell you, if you make it an allegory, you're kind of taking the two-character interpretation and you're saying it's based on the reality of romance in a man and woman relationship. Because it's an allegory of something, right? And so, to me, that argues for the two-character view. I'm not going to really talk about the three-character view. I think there's enough pretty much textual evidence. If you read this, you'd have to read it hundreds of times before you'd ever, it ever occurred to you that there could have been a third character, a second man in the story that was somehow in competition. I'll argue with you about this after if you'd like, but not for very long. But we're going to take what I think is a very literal view. When she sees her husband or groom coming up from the desert, it's Solomon. He's called Solomon. All throughout, you'll keep finding these things that she refers to the king or the Solomon. In fact, I'll just go ahead and mention this at this point. There's a play on words throughout the whole poem, in a way. Do you know what the word Solomon, where it comes from? What its root might be? If you know Jewish people, they'll often say shalom. That means, what does that mean? It kind of means like, what's the Hawaiian word for hello and goodbye and how are you doing and everything else? Aloha, right. But shalom means greetings or how is it with you? Are you at peace? Is maybe a literal. It's the word for peace, shalom. And Solomon is that word. In fact, Jerusalem is also city of peace. You hear that in all those words. And it turns out that the girl is called the Shunammite. Now, some people think that's a city. There was a city that had a name kind of like that. But, you know, another alternative is she was Mrs. Solomon. That's another way to interpret that. And what's interesting in the text that we already had read for us, if you read the very end, I'll have to find it. I'm going to read it literally. But it says, I am a wall, she said, which suggests her purity up to the time of their forming the relationship. And look at the text we just read there, chapter 8, near the end of the book. Where is it? Thank you. Verse 10. I am a wall. This is in the context of the sister. We don't know whether she'll be a wall or a door. We'll come back to that maybe if we get to it. But the woman, the Shunammite, the star of the movie here, the woman says, I am a wall. I have been pure up until marriage, I think is the point. And my breasts are like towers. That is, they're a fortress. They're protected. Thus, I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. You'll never guess what that word is. Shalom. I have become Mrs. Peace. I have become in his eyes the one who brings satisfaction, who brings peace. Solomon. Shalom. You see that? So there's a sense in the book about trying to achieve a sense of peace, both for the man and in this case, in the eyes of the groom, a peaceful relationship that she brings. So this play on words of peace, Solomon, Shunammite, and bringing contentment. That's the theme throughout the book. All right, I'm off topic, but these are important themes to think about. Okay, I think I've covered all I want to say about the interpretations, okay? The structure of the book is interesting to me, and I want to try to sneak up on that a little bit. When you read through the book, maybe you might look at it, I think, to page 3. No, it's the back page. Yeah, page 2. Start with the structure. When you read the book, one of the things you have to do is you have to think about who is speaking. And now, I'm not sure it's important to get 100% right, but if you were reading it in the original language, you can kind of tell who is speaking. Does anybody know how you can do that? When he says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, who do you think would be speaking to? Probably the woman, right? There seems like there is a chorus of sorts, and he says, we will praise you. That's probably the chorus, right? Now, sometimes it says, something is better than something. And it doesn't have a masculine or first person or third person reference that you can tell who's the woman or who's the man. But in the Hebrew, you can. And so if you really kind of look at, find a version that has the actual, maybe some proposals for who might be speaking, you can pretty well sort out who's the speaker and who's the hearer. And it's back and forth. Let me give you an example of where that's kind of important. Look at chapter 1, and we'll start with verse 15. Okay? I just get all tangled up in the details, but we'll do it anyway. Verse 15. And I like to have, when I'm teaching this class, I like to have a man read the man's part and a woman the woman's part, but you can see the play of words back and forth. Should I change my voice as I read it? Would that help? Anyway, I don't think it will. But anyway, how beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Now, who do you think said that? It's the king. And you'll notice, too, back up in verse 9, is that he has already labeled her as darling. 9 is the first time that phrase is used. Before that, he calls her something different. It's not quite as personal, right? But he starts calling her darling in verse 9, and he's still calling her that. So here you go. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. How handsome you are, my lover. And that's her term for him. So now I can tell who's speaking, right? Even though maybe in the original text I might not have a speaker. Oh, how charming. And our bed is verdant or green. I think that this is a scene based on that that's kind of maybe out in the country, in the woods perhaps. And they're surrounded by green, beautiful plants. King. The beams of our house are cedars. Our rafters are firs. Now, it's not clear there because it's a plural pronoun, and you don't know, but it seems like he is answering. She says, our bed is verdant, and he builds on that house, and he says, the rafters of our house are cedars and firs. So he's building on her imaginary house that they're building together in the woods is one way. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valley. So who do you think said that? That's like the woman, right? And he says, like a lily among the thorns is my darling among the maidens. You see how this is a back and forth? Did she mean to say, I'm so beautiful, I'm the lily of the valley, the bright and morning star, like our song says? That's not her point at all. It's the opposite, really. She just says, I'm just a common... In fact, you remember Jesus says, consider the lilies of the field? Is he saying those are spectacular, marvelous, unbelievably beautiful flowers? Or he just says, just think of the ordinary plants. And God provides for them, right? And she's saying, that's what I am. I'm just a lily. And he says, yeah, you're like a lily among thorns by comparison to anybody else. You see the point he's making there. But you can see in this little dialogue how they're kind of playing back and forth with each other's words and with each other's imaginary houses where there's a bed and rafters and so on. You see, so you kind of have to take the poem that way. So you look for that. You look for repeated words, the names they call each other. And I think you can begin to look at things that suggest that their relationship is growing. And I'm going to go through a couple of these ways in which you can see the book in a holistic way and begin to see the themes, and then maybe we'll try to take some time and read some of the text. There's a phrase that is found, first of all, in chapter 2, verse 7, do not arouse or awaken or disturb love, and it's found then again in chapter 3, verse 5, and then again it's found in chapter 8, verse 4. And you'll find that that phrase itself seems to be a build-up and a final kind of like a climax of a bunch of tension or romance or emotional power, and then that phrase, and then the scene changes. Goes to something else. Kind of interesting. So in my mind, that's a way to break the scenes and say, okay, we're going to go somewhere else. We were in the woods. Now we're going to go to the banquet hall or something like that. So there's a change of scenery, and that helps us structure that. Okay? There's the daughters of Jerusalem, and I assume that's what we maybe can call the chorus. When the people come in and say, we do this or we do that, the plural group, we can call them the daughters of Jerusalem. And the girl in the story, she will charge them. She will speak to them as part of the way she expresses her thoughts. So that's how kind of we know what she's thinking some of the time, is what she says to them. There are two sequences of dreams. And you already know this, but who's having the dreams, the guy or the girl? It's the girl. We're inside her head. In both of the dreams, she loses it. And the reason I say they're dreams is because the action sequence is a little bit fantastic. She wanders around the city. The guards find her. In one case, they beat her up. I don't think that's really a literal thing. But do you ever have dreams like that where you're looking for somebody and you can't find them? And are they often expressions of insecurity in some way or another? I've got a job interview the next day. And I have a dream that I'm running around without my pants, and I can't find them, and I don't know where they are. Do you have dreams like that? Anxiety dreams? You probably have the same dream over and over, don't you, sometimes? Often they relate to high school and lockers and things like that that were some of our original sources of insecurity. You know what I'm talking about. Well, she had those dreams, and they're about him, and they're about losing him, and about being afraid that he will go away. And she runs out and tries to find him, and terrible things happen in the dream. But anyway, that happens twice. Interestingly enough, once before they're married and once after. But you don't know about them getting married yet, but I'll get to that in a minute. But she's having these dreams that suggest an insecurity that she is hoping he will fill. Does that sound familiar from something we studied earlier? About the desire toward her husband and all that? I think you'll see that as one of the themes in the book. There are expressions of ownership, and we should look at those. Look, first of all, in 2:16. This is early in the relationship. And chapter 2, verse 16. I was wondering if there's a context. Yes. She says, "My lover is mine, and I am his." My lover is mine, and I am his. Now, that's before the wedding scene, which is in chapter 4, 3 and 4. And then now go to chapter 6, verse 3. This is afterwards. And it's after the bad dream, the second bad dream. And chapter 6, verse 4, 3, I mean, "I am my lover's, and my lover is mine." He browsed among them. Do you see a difference in those two phrases? You have to look close. Is there a difference? Yes, you found it. What is it?
In chapter 2, she starts with "my beloved is mine," and then says that I'm
his, yeah.
And she flips the order.
I wonder if that's important. If her first thought is, "I want to own this guy, right? He belongs to me," and there's a pride in that relationship. I'm not saying it's bad, it's just that was her emphasis. But after they're married and after maturing of the relationship, she flips that around. And what's her first thought about herself? "I belong to him." You see the difference there? There's one more. And it's really near the end of the book. Look where it is. I think it's chapter 8. No, it's chapter 7, verse 10. This is after, you might call it lovemaking. We'll come back to that in a minute. Look at chapter 7, verse 10. And what is said there, "I belong to my lover, and his desire is for me." Is that different? How's that different? She does. Interesting. What's the order here? Which comes first? Really, there's only one statement of ownership, right? The other thing has gone away. Her ownership of him is not in the picture. It's interesting. But she says, "I belong to him," what? But then what's the second half? You know, the Hebrew poetry is written in couplets, right? There's always a phrase and then a couplet behind it. Sometimes it says a similar thing. A stair-step couplet would expand on the meaning. What does she say? "I am my beloved's," in what? All right, I may be misquoted. What does she say?
"His desire is for me."
His desire is for me. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard that word desire before in this session? And we argued, we didn't argue, but I thought some people might argue with me, about what that meant. You remember in the curse in the garden, what's the curse on Eve? "Your desire shall meet your husband, and he shall rule over you." And we said, what in the world can that desire mean? And it was this strange Hebrew word, which I think is something like teshukah or something like that. That's the word. And we decided it might mean that she's trying to dominate him, but probably not. It has to do with reaching out and trying to grasp hold of something. It was her desire to hold him to her, to be secure in that relationship. Did I convince you of that, by the way? I don't know if I did or not. But that's what I think that word means. I want to tell you, there's only three times in the Old Testament that word is ever used. We've covered two of them already, right? Remember Genesis 4 is sin is crouching at the door, but you... And its desire is for you, but you will love it. Remember that? I don't know if y'all remember that. It's Friday night, I think. This is the third time it's used in the whole Bible. Only the third time. And now, what's interesting about it is whose desire is for whom in this verse? Back to the expert on noticing things. Is it the woman's desire is for him or something different?
No, it's his desire.
His desire. He's reaching out for her. He is trying to draw him into that relationship and hold her tight. You see that? Isn't that interesting? The only time it's used in the Bible, besides those first few times in Genesis. And we argue about what it might mean in Genesis, but it seems to me this is a great place where that comes back. in this growing relationship where at first she wants to own him and draw him in. Later, that's less important than being owned by him. And later, the most important thing is, he is drawing me into him. You know what I mean? That's the way she's described that. Interesting coincidence, perhaps, but I think not a coincidence. Okay, some other things. There are progressive praise poems. I'm not going to look at these in particular, but they're some of the most, you might say, sensitive elements, but in particular, he will praise her from head to toe or from toe to head. Sometimes it goes upward, sometimes it goes down. But he'll say your eyes and your temples and your neck and your breast and your, you know, that kind of thing. And each time, the list gets longer. It's interesting. And in some ways, it gets more intimate, parts are described. Why? Is that a significant thing in a relationship? That when you get to know someone, you notice more things about them? I hope you notice more good things about them. And they seem more beautiful. And things you hadn't even noticed before become more a permanent part of what you admire. And I think you see that sequence throughout the Psalms. So we won't cover the details, but you just look at a couple of those and you'll see the difference in the intimacy. That's the point I just made right there. There's a sense of in which before the wedding and after the wedding, there is a request, and you find a companion verse later in the book that seems to fulfill that request. In the beginning of the book says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. That seems to be the proper translation. Does that suggest they've already kissed, or she's just wishing for that? Seems like it's a prospective thing, right? And then, later in the relationship, chapter 7, your mouth, like the best wine, may the wine go straight to my beloved, flowing gently over lips and teeth. So they not only are kissing, they're kind of into it. You know, it's a kind of an intimate thing that they're pretty expert at, if I can say it that way. And without, I'm not trying to be inappropriate. I'm just saying that's the way life is. That's the way relationships grow. In chapter 2, she says, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the rugged hills. And then the groom says, actually the wedding night, until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to my mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. And that's symbolic language, but you can guess what that might be implying. And then chapter 2, verse 10, before the wedding, arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. And then later, it's the same voice, and she's inviting him to go to the countryside. And then we see them, almost from a distance, in chapter 8, verse 5, and they're leaning on each other, and they're coming back from their vacation in the country. That's the picture we have of them. And I think in a mature relationship, they even talk about their moms and their sister and others that have an interest besides their just little romance. Now they're aware of the rest of the world, and they're coming up from a common vacation, shared together in the countryside. That's the way we see them. Instead of having to invite one another out and all of that. Here's the intimacy thing. There's an evolution of terms. In the very beginning, she calls him the king, my beloved. As they're getting closer to the wedding, he is the one that my heart loves. That's at the dream sequence. At the wedding, he's Solomon fairly formally, but then he is my beloved, my friend, and at the very end, Solomon. And the one in whose eyes she has brought peace. And for her, he calls her at the very beginning, most beautiful of women. But then in chapter 1, verse 9, he begins to call her my darling. This seems to be the favorite nickname. But when he gets in trouble, or let's just say at the wedding scene and later when he's trying to, when they're having a reconciliation of sorts, he has lots of terms for her. He knows how to use complimentary terms to win her heart or win her heart back. So you can kind of see that terms like that. And then I think, and maybe I'm stretching it a little bit, but I believe that in the relationship, she becomes more comfortable in initiating actions. Does that happen in a relationship? In the women, perhaps? I don't know, maybe she bosses them around from the very beginning. I don't know. But what I think I see is, as they grow in their maturity and they even can read one another's thoughts, she's free to initiate action and make plans and propose them. Whereas early on, she's waiting for him to make the moves. Does this happen in your relationship? That's kind of the way it is. Okay. They are aware of each other early, but they're aware more of the external world in the latter part of the book. Did you notice the red line on all these charts?
Yes.
What is the red line?
What is the red line?
Thank you for asking that question. That's the wedding. And her self-image grows. We'll talk about that maybe. In fact, let's just stop and talk about the red line. Thank you for asking me. Go to chapter 3. And I think we'll start in verse 6. I wish the chapters weren't even in the book. What I wish somebody had done in the translation, and by the way, that's what I study from, and I've kind of made my own copy, where I just have the scenes and the speakers. And I suggest if you really want to study the book, go ahead and do that. And the NIV makes a try at that. If you start with the New International Version, it will have the speakers identified, like paragraph headings. Not inspired, it's not a translation of Hebrew, but it's a start for knowing who's speaking. And then you can begin to see where the breakpoints are and break the thing into scenes. I'm going to show you what the scenes are in just a minute. But I'll tell you, as you start the whole book, you think, I don't know what's going on. They're talking about plants and animals and myrrh and mountains and I don't know what's going on. But finally, you get, if you're just kind of first reading, you get to chapter 3, verse 6. And I'm going to read this, and you tell me what you think is happening. Who is this, coming up from the desert like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look! It's Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with a sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself a carriage. He made it of the wood of Lebanon. Its post was made of silver, its base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple, the interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day his heart rejoiced. What do you think is happening in that text? Any idea? Could be coming back. That's true. That's right. But it's a wedding, right? Either whether he's coming back, I think he's coming up like as he's going to the ceremony, perhaps. Maybe it's coming out, but the idea is, here's the wedding, and he is coming up in the distance with a cloud of dust and smoke from all those warriors that are with him. You see? Is this a noble picture of a worthy husband? Again, whose eyes are we seeing the groom through? It's the girl. Now, what is she seeing in him? Is she seeing strength? Is she seeing protection and power? Is she seeing adequate wealth to provide for her needs? Oh, yeah. I mean, look at that carriage that he's got with him, right? Is she seeing security coming her way? I think so. You see that? Coming up, yeah. Now, I guess what I'm saying is, I think I know what's happening in the story at this point, at least. Now, before, I'm not so sure. That's the red line. But let's keep reading and see if we can figure out what happens after that. What do you think would happen after the wedding ceremony? What normally happens after the wedding? You have to say it out loud, okay? We'll just say honeymoon, right? Did you get the idea? I wonder if that might be the case. Let's read. The king speaks. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful. Your eyes behind your veils are dove. That veil are dove. Your hair is like a flock of goats. I'm not going to read all these because you might start thinking she's really ugly. Her necklace like a tower and a bunch of other things. But that's not the intent. You understand, he is drawing on the image of the most beautiful buildings and mountains and plants that there are to say, this is what I think of when I look at you. That's what he's saying to this. He is praising her beauty. And he can't say she looks like a current day movie star because there aren't any. But he can just say that he is your breasts are like two fawns, twin fawns of the gazelle that browse among the lilies. You see, well, I mean, you can get the imagery, you get the sense and the flavor of that, the sensitive but also beautiful. See, I'm just struggling here myself, but you know, the arousing kind of images that would be there, so I'm trying to say. And he says then, until the day breaks and the shadows flee, this is one of those requests fulfilled, I will go to the mountain of myrrh, the hill of incense. All beautiful you are, my darling, and there is no flaw in you. What do you think is happening here in the story, right after the wedding scene? I think he is praising her beauty as a precursor to their lovemaking. Right? And that's going to keep on reading. What's interesting to me, then, verse 8, he says, come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me. Descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Sinir, from the summit of Hermon. Do you know these are snow-capped mountains in Israel? Why is he telling her to come down from the mountains? What's the point? What do you think those mountains represented in those days?
Isolation.
It didn't represent a ski vacation. It represented danger, right, and distance. And as you said, isolation, and even maybe loneliness. Did people live up on those snow-capped mountains? No, of course they didn't. It was a place of loneliness, of danger, of not being protected. He said, come down out of that. Come down to the sea. From the lion's dens and the mountain haunts of the leopards. Does that sound safe? No, come out of that. We're going to come to a secure place. You've stolen my heart, my sister. That's, I think, the first time he calls her his sister. Why would he call her his sister? Is she literally his sister? Or is that a term of family endearment at this point? You've stolen my heart. With one glance of your eyes, one jewel of your necklace, how delightful is your love. Do you see what he's doing? Here in this sensitive scene after the wedding, he is reassuring her of her own worth and beauty. He is giving her a sense of security. He's telling her what a deep effect that she has on him emotionally. Would a woman like to hear that? Would she like to hear it on a wedding night? I think so. And what he's doing is he's giving her that sense of security that she maybe has longed for and dreamed of with regard to their relationship. And he goes on, he just can't stop, right? But look at verse 12. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride, a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Now that's a strange imagery. Why is he talking about how her doors are shut and the locks are locked? What's the point of that? And it's a compliment, I think. It's not a criticism, don't you agree? Why would he praise her for her, the closed fountain and the sealed garden? Not me, that much backwards. She was pure. He does not say she's frigid or barren. That's not the point. Inside that garden is beauty and lush health and a lot of beautiful things. But it's been secure. It's been secure. It's locked up till now. Till now. You keep reading. And he goes on to say how verdant her garden is, right? 13 through 15. She's not, there's nothing wrong with her in some physical, sexual way. She's just in. And so, guess what the woman says in verse 16? Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden. Is she letting him in? That its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste his choice fruits. It's not locked anymore. There's just one person who's allowed in. Now, is that a wonderful, beautiful experience that he's going to have and she's going to have and they're going to have together? Yes. What makes it good is that it's locked up. And it's private. We mentioned it earlier. It's only shared between the two of them. You see that? And all the anticipation that led up to that, and even the bad dreams and everything, are longing for this moment where they now share that intimacy. And you see that it's more beautiful and more secure. That was our point earlier when we were looking at the one flesh passage in Jesus at 19. It's not to be put aside. It's more secure because it's only shared with her. We saw that in the Proverbs, right? That it's your own sister, only to be shared with you. That's the thing that builds security in the relationship. And by the way, who is it of the two that needs security the most? It's the woman. That's her desire. Why? Because we're in a fallen world, for one thing. We looked at that Friday night. From the very beginning, the man is ruling over the world. He's tending the garden. Now he's doing it by the sweat of his face. Meanwhile, the woman's having pain in childbirth, and her desire is for her husband, but he's often abusive because of the fallen world in which you live. She needs protection and security. How do you get that? By giving yourself to any man? Or by looking for that one man that can bring you from the mountains of Lebanon and those places of isolation, loneliness, insecurity, and danger, and provide a protection. Now, what's the red line? That's it. And the wedding night together. So when I was showing those things before and after, it's after that this event you just read about. And so when I begin to interpret the book, that's to me an anchor point. I can see what's happening there. It makes sense to me. You know what I mean? It's not quite symbolic. Now, if I go back earlier and they say, we're sitting, our bed is burning, does that mean they're on a real bed? Or are they just playtime and you make it? I don't know for sure. But I would put it in the context of before the wedding just because of how clear that part of the text is. Does that make sense? Do everybody understand what we're doing? It's just a way to interpret the book. Like there's a probably a better example of that. So go back before the wedding in chapter 2. I got to get to the punchline again. Go back to chapter 2, for example. I call this the Tigger scene. Y'all know who Tigger is? Too many to poo. How does he always arrive on the scene? He bounces in. Thank you. You know how that works. He bounces in. Listen, my lover, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. Is he like a gazelle or a young stag? He stands behind the wall. This suggests, by the way, they don't live together. He's coming to visit. What time of day do you think this is? It's hard to tell. The cooing of the doves in verse 12, other things suggest it's early morning. He's coming to see her in the daytime. And he's bouncing all around. He's all excited. And she's not out yet. And she's peeking in all the windows. He's like, let me see your face. I mean, where are you? Where are you? You know what I mean? This is a date they're going to go on. And he's excited to see her. Now, how much of that's literal, how much is figurative, I don't really know. But I put it in the context of their pre-marriage, the accounts. And so, and they're in a banqueting hall. And she's nervous. She's very nervous. But she's, her relationship with him is like a fragrant bouquet of myrrh, perfume. Maybe literal, but probably meaning kind of symbolically, the fact that he's invited me and I'm honored here is really kind of who I am. It's made me feel beautiful. You know, you women probably can help me explain this better. But is it the case that when you're in a relationship with someone who makes you feel beautiful, you kind of are more beautiful? You certainly feel that way, right? And that your identity is enhanced, and your feeling of beauty is enhanced because of that identity you have. Mm-hmm. You're nodding yes. I think you're just being sympathetic to me, but y'all know what I'm talking about. Is it true that in effect the relationship on the woman, the way she looks and feels, and her identity and herself worth is all going to be affected, and you can kind of see that happening. And then after they're married, of course, it's still the same, but it's actually there's more security in it. And so she can initiate a visit to the countryside. At one point she says, you know, I wish you were my brother. Because then we could kiss in public and nobody would think anything about it. She's wanting to have some intimacy, right? But it's kind of a fun thing. That somehow or another, because they're not brother and sister, if people would interpret it as lovemaking in public. So, anyway. Alright, so let's go back and I'll kind of try to finish up. Do you sense now what the song is about? Let me show you a picture that might help with the structure. So the red line is just what we said. It's the wedding scene, procession. I don't know. I was thinking, I never thought about being after his wedding. But in any case, one way or the other, he's coming forward or back. Why did you say that? I think you must have a good reason.
Well, it says to which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding.
On the day of his wedding.
She crowned him at the wedding.
Oh. That's good. That's good. That's a great point. Anyway, it's his wedding day, right? Either before or after the ceremony, right? And then the wedding night, that's pretty obvious. And then what you can do then is you can work your way backward, and you see kind of matching scenes there. Before the wedding, she seems to be having some anxiety, not about whether he's the right man, but whether he will continue, whether she can hold on to him, right? Because they're not married yet. You can read that dream sequence. And this is where she wakes up, and she runs out, and she finally does, I think she finds him in this scene. And the same thing happens after they're married. Only thing there is, I think there's a real situation. If you look in chapter 5, he comes in the middle of the night and knocks on the door. I think that the idea is that she maybe had her own sleeping quarters or something. And so he comes, as a husband would, in the night to knock on her door. And you can guess why he's knocking on her door. In the night. And she says, not that this ever happens, I've already cleaned my feet, I'm already in bed, why don't you go away and come back another time? Has that ever happened before? Women say, I'll say no, that never happened. And anyway, it doesn't work out good. And she realizes instantly that was a mistake. And I maybe have upset him. And she all of a sudden has another kind of think a bad dream. She goes out, she gets beat up. And then there's a scene in which, because the relationship is potentially broken because of her rejection of him, in which there's a slow reconciliation. And the daughters of Jerusalem help her deal with that problem. It's fascinating to me. And they do that by asking her three questions. And I'm trying to remember the order. I should remember this. But let's just look and see right quick. Chapter 5. I should have these marked better, but I don't have it. Okay, I don't really have time. There are three questions. I don't know the exact order. I think the first question is, who are you? And the answer seems to be, I was just a little country girl, but now I'm like queen. And the implication is, how did that happen? Well, because of my husband. And then, who is he? And she praises him and realizes how beautiful he is. And then, where is he and what are his interests? Where might he be? So they really kind of bring that reconciliation about by asking her questions about her husband, about her state as a result of that blessing, and finally about his interests. So it turns her attention then back to the relationship. I'm going to come back to that at the end. I hope I can get the order straight at that point. And on the wedding night, there's a scene there, but after the reconciliation here, based on the three questions, then there's later intimacy where he describes her, but now he has more things to praise than he did on the wedding night, right? There's something similar, but before they're married, they're together in the spring. There's a banquet in the forest. Later, after they're married, they go into the countryside and see the blooms, which seems to be an echo of what happened earlier in the book. In the very beginning, she's thinking about him, let him kiss me, and he's beautiful and handsome and all that. At the end of the book is that discussion, really, of a retrospective of the romance. So that's kind of a picture form of the structure of the book. Maybe some of it's not exactly right, but that's the way I kind of set the scenes and determine what's going on based on the talking. And then there are the repeated phrases I'll mention. For example, in 2:7, do not arouse love. She mentions that. That seems to be like a break point, and then another scene follows that happens again right before the wedding procession, and then it happens again at the very end of the book. It's kind of like a summary before the actual retrospective thoughts about the romance. My lover is mine and I'm his. I am my lover's and my lover is mine. I belong to my lover and his desires for me. The three expressions of ownership we talked about, I think, also tie together the book, both before and after. And then this phrase, till the day breaks, is echoed then as almost as a fulfillment after the wedding. And then finally, at the very end, the book almost ends with that phrase as well. Okay. There's one theory that this is just a collection of love poems. I think it has way more unity than that. I see it tied together both in terms of sequence and progression and repeated phrases. I think it's a unit. I think it's a beautiful unit. It's held together by so many themes and words and images. And you kind of have to look into what some of those images are. Mount Hermon and myrrh and all those other things like that. But this is a structure that might help you look at that. And of course, we've mentioned all the other things. So here's an outline. I'll leave these charts. Maybe a way that you can read the book and get some sense of what the book is about. I think we talked about that. And that's what I was going to say there. That's that Hebrew word, just as before. Now, I started by saying that the book was often interpreted as an allegory, I think in some ways to avoid thinking that it was literal, that there was a real Shulamite girl and Solomon had a kind of monogamous, beautiful romantic relationship. I think he did. Even if he didn't, I think he wrote about it in the ideal, and that's maybe this story. But some people have made it an allegory of God's treatment of his people. And I think that's not too far off. Because doesn't God treat the man-woman relationship as is it really an allegory? It's a shadow, perhaps? It's an object lesson that we can all live and learn from, but to understand what? Christ in the church. Paul says in Ephesians 11, the mystery is great, but I speak in respect of Christ in the church.
I think we understand our relationship to God as if we were the bride, and God himself, Jehovah in the Old Testament, and Christ the bridegroom in the New Testament, we are betrothed to him. Now, I will tell you, the frightening thing about the idea that I can have a relationship with God, what is the thing that comes to your mind, or ought to, as you look at your own sinfulness? Is that, am I worthy of that? You see that? And I'm quite insecure in my sinfulness, in my weakness, in my finiteness in so many ways. Isn't that similar to what we've seen in the woman from the very beginning of time, in the fall itself, where her desire or insecurity is kind of a theme that keeps getting addressed in the Law of Moses, in the Song of Solomon? She starts out saying, I'm dark and ugly. I can't even use the word ugly, but she says, my brothers made me work in the fields, which made her look like she was just a peasant girl because she was all tanned and everything, because they made her work in the field. Before it's over, he's saying, no, you're lily among the thorns. And he praises every element of her beauty, in particular, her skin is one thing, the beauty of her. So she starts out feeling unworthy and insecure. And what does her relationship with the king, make her feel by the end? Beautiful. Secure. Protected. Right? Mrs. Shalom. Mrs. Solomon. Peace. And she brings peace to him as well. But this is, I think, what we're kind of seeing in this as an overall picture. You might say, I don't think the Song of Solomon is an allegory of Jehovah and Israel, but marriage probably is an allegory, a shadow of God's relationship with his people. So when we're here this weekend talking about being better husbands and wives or better parents, you understand we are in a sense a shadow of that great relationship that God the Creator has formed with us as his children and maybe eventually as his bride. I'm not saying it's an allegory, but I think we've been studying an allegory all weekend. It's Ezekiel 16, I won't look at it, but you may be familiar with the story of the baby who is just unwanted and cast out, lying in its own blood on the side of the road. It was a baby girl, as a matter of fact. You know that story? And the man comes along in the place of, in the person of Jehovah, and rescues that baby. He cleans it up. And she grows up to be a beautiful girl. And he decorates her with all kinds of ornaments, jewelry, and other evidence of beauty. And she's nourished, and she becomes quite healthy. In fact, it says in that text in verse 8 that Jehovah spread his wings over her. Spread his wings over her. And I think that's a metaphor for maybe a bird who might protect its eggs, or some person of strength who would put that strength and protect those elements under the wing. You see that? It's in fact the same word that in the book of Ruth, Boaz says, it's pretty clear when he sees Ruth, another romantic story by the way, God spread his wings over you. He sure has taken care of you, you Moabite woman. But I'm amazed at what God has done to protect you, spread his wings over you. What's interesting is at night, and I'm talking about, this phrase is in Ezekiel, God spread his wings over this orphan girl, and he brought her to beauty and protected her. But in the book of Ruth, you remember she goes down and lies at Boaz's feet at night. You remember that story? Right? And what does she say to him? I'm Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing. For you're a close relative. Now, some translations say, put the skirt of your cloak over me or something. And it can mean that, but it probably just means it's the tip of a wing. It's the same phrase. What Ruth is asking Boaz to do is to come and protect her, because he's the next of kin. Put me under your care, even though I'm a Moabite. I'm a widow. But she's saying, I need your protection. I need your cover. And so that same phrase is used there. Put me under your wings. The same thing that describes Jehovah's care of Israel in Ezekiel chapter 16. And I think in our self-centeredness, when we feel like we've violated God's commands and we're not worthy and we've messed up and we've forsaken him, we've done the wrong things, I think there's the three questions that are asked in Song of Solomon. Who are you as a result of your relationship with God? And who is
he and what are his interests? And I think those are the things that draw us back to that secure relationship with our betrothed husband, that we someday will be at peace because of our relationship. Can we do invitations? Is that? I think that's a pretty appropriate place.